Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF. Okay, how's it going, folks? What's happening? You want me to do the whole thing? This is a special episode. Let's do this. How are you? Everybody all right? Special episode. So we did one of these last year, and people liked it, so we're doing it again. It's basically Oscar-centric, but by way of the history of this show. As usual, a lot of the year's Oscar nominees have been on the show for long talks about their lives and careers and stuff. 14 of this year's nominees have been WTF guests in the past. This is one of those exciting things where I don't even realize, because I'm just in the day. I'm moving forward. Sometimes I don't even remember the people we've had on, but this is amazing. We're going to kick it off here with Paul Giamatti, who was nominated for Best Actor for The Holdovers. This was a talk that was so good, we made it our 1,500th episode.
Do you have any of your movies that you like look at and you're like, oh my God, what was that?
Probably. I don't know. I don't watch a whole lot of them. I did this kids movie that's probably the weirdest thing.
Really?
Yeah, I did this movie called Big Fat Liar.
Yeah.
That's like kids, generations, generations of people have seen this thing.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really strange.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's going to be one of those movies when these kids grow up, like, I had no idea what that was about.
Totally. That would be amazing if that was their Paris, Texas. And their Blue Velvet. Yeah. Now I'd love that, actually. That would be great. I've never even thought that that's going into people's kids' heads and it might be the same thing. I never thought about that.
Yeah.
That is fucking some bizarre thing that's
going to haunt
a kid.
Yeah.
I know, but I never really think of that.
I was recently exploring the fact that my grandparents accidentally took me and my brother, when they were visiting us in New Mexico, to see Deliverance, not knowing what it was, like when it came out.
Sure.
And the weird thing about that, though, Paul, was that, like, I remember the rape scene, but all I remember was there was a man in his underwear, you know, and they're
right,
making him make
weird
noises.
Yeah, right.
That's all I remember.
Sure.
And then I watched it again recently. I'm like, holy fuck.
Holy shit.
They really raped that
guy. That movie's terrifying.
But my child brain didn't register it.
No, you didn't get it. No,
yeah,
you didn't get
exactly.
It. No, you just didn't get it.
It's the same with
Blue Velvet. My mother did that with Blue Velvet. My mother did that stuff, took us through like wildly inappropriate things like that. I'm glad because it went in, you know what I mean? Like I absorbed it. And that's cool because something went in there
in
an interesting way. But I didn't know what the fuck was going on.
Yeah.
I remember seeing The Conversation.
Yeah, that's a hard
movie.
And it
was terrifying to me. It was just scary. Yeah. I was like, I don't know what's going on. I have no
idea
what's going on.
That guy's just taken apart his entire house.
I don't know what's going on. But it terrified me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I absorbed the menace.
Because of the obsession of it.
I got the menace of it.
Right, right,
right. Nothing else.
And that's a very like mental menace.
Yeah. Yeah, you feel the menace of it even as a little kid.
So you decide, you go to Yale undergrad?
Yeah.
And you study what?
I studied English. I ended up studying English.
Did you take your dad's class?
No, he was not there anymore.
Oh, he wasn't?
No. No, he'd left. He'd left by then.
And where'd he go?
He sort of didn't do anything for a little while.
Was that a weird time?
Probably for him it was, yeah.
Were your parents together?
Yes, they were. Yes. Yes, they were together. I guess. I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, probably would have been better not to.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Yeah, he took like he took a couple of maybe a year or two before he,
became the baseball commissioner.
Before he went into baseball,
but he was the president of Yale.
He was
for years.
No, not for that long. I think most of those guys stay in that job for years.
Yeah,
I don't think he liked doing it.
It's hard to be a bureaucrat in academia.
Yeah,
my buddy's
not fun. I don't think
he's a writer. He's a teacher at Columbia, and he's a brilliant guy.
Yeah,
Sam Lipsight. Yeah. Uh-huh. And, but like when you hear about what it takes to be like a tenured guy and just to deal with school stuff.
I said it's a Shark Tank and it's like, I don't think he, I think he thought that was going to be maybe more enjoyable than it was and it wasn't.
Yeah, because you're a manager.
You're a manager at the best. And it's like, you're just you're raising money the whole time.
So when you did undergrad, did you learn anything? What was your focus?
I guess like American, the 19th century American stuff, like Poe and Melville.
Oh, really?
Stuff, which was stuff I liked to read. So that was
good. Easier. I was a romantic literature. It was my focus undergrad, but both semesters of the focus, it was at 9 in the morning, and it was tough Jesus going, Christ. Dude.
And so you mean like reading like
Shelley,
Byron, Yates, and stuff?
Byron, yeah.
I can't read poetry. It makes no sense.
And I was cramming it.
My
and
brain
like
is not.
I'm not. I think I might. Still have an incomplete.
I'm pretty sure I probably do.
It was a paper on Blake.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Well, that stuff actually I can read. That's sort of, some of that makes sense.
But
to
yeah.
Me.
Well, yeah. It's very simple language. But then there are the drawings, and then there's just
some
books upon books of analysis. And I'm like, what are they seeing?
I know. Why are you? Well, that's a whole other thing. Is the critical shit I couldn't read. No. So it was good because I was reading like Edgar Allan Poe. Yeah. So I mean, like horror stories.
Yeah.
So that was good.
Yeah. But then you get done with that and you decide, like, I don't want to teach?
I think the thing that I did, I don't know that I learned much about it, but I did a lot of extracurricular theater
right.
undergraduate.
Yeah.
That's really what I ended
up doing. So, like, the non-theater school theater company.
Yeah. So, that's what,
like, what plays you do?
Whatever. You would do...
I did Indian Wants a Bronc.
That kind of thing a lot. People did Hurly Burly and stuff like that a lot. I didn't
Zoo
do that.
Story.
We did Zoo Story. We did Glengarry Glen Ross.
Oh, that's bold.
Yeah, that was bold because I think they didn't have the rights to it.
Oh, right.
When we did it.
A bunch of 19-year-olds doing Glengarry.
Totally. Sitting around in trench coats trying to be like old Jews from Chicago. No, totally. Powder, the white powder in your hair, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Fantastic, though. Fantastic. I mean, so great that we had the fucking
solid,
balls
man.
To do it.
Everyone's parents loved it.
Absolutely. And who knows? Maybe it was good.
Yeah.
Maybe it was good.
I think people
maybe
can suspend
just
their
maybe it was good. But stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so, whatever. Just
but you
all
took
kinds
to
of
it.
Stuff.
You were like, oh, yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed doing that.
Yeah.
So I think probably I don't know if I learned anything, but that's what I did.
Yeah. That was episode 1500 with Paul Giamatti. Another Best Actor nominee was on last year when he was making the rounds for Oppenheimer. I didn't know, like a lot of times with actors, I'm not even sure they can talk. But this was great. Here's me and Cillian Murphy. So the relationship with Nolan is like 6 movies long now.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, what have you learned from that guy? How does he work?
I think he's kind of like, I think he might be the perfect director. You know, he's got all of the facets that you need in the perfect director. He's amazing with actors. He's incredibly brilliant visually. He writes the things himself and they're made for the theaters. You know, they are like event movies, but they challenge you.
Yeah.
You know, I love the way he presupposes a level of intelligence in the audience.
Yeah, it doesn't happen often.
No, and he knows the audience aren't dummies and he knows the audience can keep up and he knows the audiences want to be provoked and challenged. And I love working with him and he really pushes it. You know, he expects the best from you and he's rigorous at everything and like demanding.
The sets are huge too. I mean,
the sets are huge. But here's the weird thing. The sets are huge, but it feels like being on an independent movie. There's just Chris and the cameraman, one camera always, unless there's some huge, huge set piece.
Yeah.
And the boom up and that's it. And there's no video village, there's no monitors, there's nothing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He doesn't use any of that?
None of that. I mean, he's a very kind of analog filmmaker.
Interesting.
You know?
Even on Dunkirk?
Mm-hmm.
Man.
Yeah, and I didn't see a frame in this movie until I saw the first teaser.
Of Oppenheimer?
Yeah, I hadn't seen anything. And I've never seen anything on Chris's films until I see the trailer or the finished thing.
Really?
Yeah. And he rarely does ADR. I've done 6 movies with him. I think I've done like 4 lines of ADR.
No shit.
Yeah, because he records sound really well, and he believes in production, you know, production sound, and he creates an environment for the actors. There's no green screen. There's no none of that.
I found it to be. So, like, the guy, there was, you know, it was a press screening, so it wasn't packed. It wasn't a premiere or anything.
Yeah.
But whoever was running it was like, all right, this is a 70mm print on film the way Chris wanted you to see it.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I felt like it does make a difference.
I think it does.
And I was highly aware of it for some reason in that movie. I know there's other movies that are shot like that. I mean, Tarantino shoots like that.
Yeah.
But because you're in IMAX... You know, it's like, you know, it's different. The effect is different.
I mean, Chris says it's kind of like 3D without being 3D. Yeah.
I guess. To me, it just reminds me of like movies, theaters when I was a kid. Just a big old screen, you know, where you feel like you're really at an event.
Yeah.
But like the opportunity, and like for me, like as, look, I did one scene with De Niro in passing in Joker. And I'm sure he has no recollection of me. It didn't matter. I was a, you know, it was just whatever it was. But, you know, there is that awareness. And I imagine even though you've done, you know, dozens of movies at this point, there's awareness. Yeah, these are just people. And certainly, you know, that actors are painfully people.
Yes, I do.
But you're aware that sort of like, all right, you know, game on. I'm sitting here with Casey Affleck and we got to do this thing.
Yeah.
And like, I always like seeing that guy.
Yeah, man, he's so good in the movie. That was great. That was a big scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he came in and he was ready to go. And it was, again, all these stupid kind of analogies.
But, yeah.
You know, it does raise your game. It does make you better when you're working with the best actors. It does do that. And it's true. And this was a perfect case in point. Like, you have these, some of my favorite actors in the world.
Yeah.
Because they all want to work with Chris.
Yeah.
So they all come in and they play these parts. And the other thing about the movie, I think, is because you got a lot of movie stars in it, but every character they play, they're very significant characters. So it doesn't feel like cameos, if you know what I mean, because they're all playing these real life characters who had a big impact on the world.
And also, I didn't feel the movie starness of anybody.
Yeah.
And that's sort of a miracle. But it's just so interesting that you had to carry this movie in this character that operates at a level, right? Like, you know, you definitely have, you're holding on to this stuff that you're talking about. And his affectation is what it is, which doesn't, you know, he is who he is all the way through. And then you just, all of a sudden, these other actors, like, you got to deal with Downey, steps into this thing.
Yeah.
And I imagine that, you know, just holding on to the character you've built in certain moments, you have to be aware of that.
Yeah.
Like, you're sort of like, all right, just stay focused.
Yeah, of course. But it was a joy, man.
Yeah.
It was a joy working with these actors.
Yeah.
Like, I really felt, I'll probably never get a chance to work with an ensemble of actors again.
God.
It'll probably never happen. So I just, I enjoyed every minute of it.
Yeah.
And again, you know, we talked about, like, learning. You look at all those amazing actors, you work with all those amazing actors, you're always learning, you're always figuring stuff out as an actor.
Yeah.
And this was like just special.
That's Cillian Murphy from episode 1453. Now, okay, so Best Actor nominee Jeffrey Wright was on the show back when we were still doing remote interviews because of the pandemic. But it was still great. This is from episode 1126. Jeffrey is nominated for his performance in American Fiction. It's interesting because I'll ask actors about process and, you know, how they ultimately everyone's going to put together their own, you know, set of tools or however they're going to do it. You know what I mean? There's no way to say like, well, you do this, you do this, you do this, because everyone's going to do it their way. But, you know, from taking from all these different people, you know, and adding it to, you know, your natural ability. I mean, what do you remember every time that you go into a role? You know, how do you start and, you know, where did you get that information? Like, do you look back at the people that guided you early on? Is there any bit of information that, you know, really stands out as like that was it?
Well, I mean, I think you put it all in your pocket, you know what I mean? And you pull out as needed, and it all kind of merges together, you know? So many great influences, and also other actors that you work with. I mean, for example, you talk about Shakespeare. One guy who taught me perhaps more than any other one individual about performing Shakespeare is someone you probably wouldn't expect. And that's Chris Walken.
Yeah?
Yeah. Joe Dowling gave me a gig, you know, bit part, Shakespeare in the Park. I think I was, 23 years old, 20, whatever it was. And Chris Walken played Iago to Raul Julia's Othello. And I talk about this if I talk to, you know, young, you know, actors, now, you know, sometimes I'll go and, you know, talk to a class and, I'll talk about Walken, particularly, relative to Shakespeare, because, you know, Walken's from Queens, right? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And Chris,
a song and dance man.
It's Chris. Yeah. Badass. Yeah. But when he does Shakespeare, he's not interested in any affectation, you know? It's Chris Walken. Zvlads, but you're not hear me. I mean, it's, you know, it's, and he personalizes that language and just kind of destroys any unnecessary reverence for it, which is particularly important, I think, for an American actor to claim it. In his own voice and in his own rhythms and his own tones. And I mean, he's one of, if not the smartest actor I've ever had the privilege of working with. And yeah, you know, because, you know, there's nothing more annoying than seeing an American actor do some kind of faux fake ass British weird half British accent when doing Shakespeare. You
sure.
know what I mean? It was just so unnatural and weird.
Okay, so back in 2016, we had Annette Bening on the show. That's episode 769, and she's nominated this year for Best Actress for her performance in Naiad.
Like, you've been nominated many times, and I think you should win.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, get on the phone. No, that would be wrong.
I can't imagine. I can't, like, when I watch if and when I watch the Oscars, just that horrible feeling of like waiting to hear. I can't imagine that.
Yeah, it's a funny feeling.
And then you got to be happy, you know, yeah. for them. Like, yeah, that's when, you know, it's always what I'm watching. It's like that moment.
Yeah, we all do.
Yeah, that moment.
Because like, that's the human experience that's the most interesting.
But I've never seen anyone go like, oh, fuck.
Actually, I think there was an actor many years ago who did like stand up and throw his hat on the ground and say shit when he lost. So yeah, you see little glimmers of that. I remember the first time I was nominated in the supporting actress category with a bunch of amazing women. And
Which movie?
The Grifters.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the other actresses. And we all got together before the show was on the air, because in those days, actually, they didn't turn the cameras on. So everyone's talking and chatting. And
right.
So we all get together in a little group, and we're like, okay, whoever wins next week takes all of us out to dinner and they pay.
Yeah.
So Whoopi Goldberg won.
Yeah.
The next, just like a day or two later, I got a big bouquet of flowers with a card. It said, meet at the such and such a restaurant at such and such a time.
Yeah.
We show up. One of us couldn't be there, but we were all there together. Whoopi brings out gardenias for each of us on a tray and chocolate Oscars. I'm not kidding. And we all had dinner. And it was the most...
Who else was there?
Beautiful.
Do you remember?
Lorraine Bracco, Diane Ladd, Mary McDonnell.
Oh.
Mary McDonnell, me, Whoopi. Lorraine couldn't come to the dinner, but yeah. Mary was there, Diane Ladd was there, me and Whoopi. It was amazing.
That's sweet.
It was. It was like one of those moments of, wow.
Well, that's so nice, because that was like, again, it relates to the kind of never-ending appetite of the media. That, you know, everything that happens before and everything, like everybody just, you had a privacy moment. You had a private moment.
Just
you and the other actresses.
Exactly. It was so meaningful. My parents were with me at the awards show. And I remember it never occurred to me. I didn't even think about it until the very last minute. Oh, they could actually call my name.
Yeah.
Right. But then they didn't. And it was really quick. It was like, no, they didn't. Ah. And also, that's just like one of the first awards of the night. So then it was over really quickly. And I was like, okay, well, who cares? I'm still here. It's fun.
In the supporting categories, we've had a bunch of this year's nominees on the show. One of them from back in 2021. And this was actually an amazing talk.
It's with Jodie Foster. It was during COVID. She was at home. I don't know. It was just one of those things that seemed to be something that would never happen again in this way in terms of conversationally. Jodie's nominated for Best Supporting Actress for NIAID.
I mean, the whole point of having a production company was to protect people, was to protect filmmakers and
right.
to protect the process and to protect the product.
Yeah.
That's why I called it Egg, you know, that idea of sort of
your production company.
Protection.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we made some, you know, I don't think I'm the greatest producer in the world, but we made some movies that I'm really proud of. There isn't any film that we made that I'm not proud of. And yet at the same time, it was clear when I finished the 12 years of producing that, like, yeah, I was done. It's enough of that.
I thought Nell was a pretty gutsy movie. It's really like to do that role. I mean, your ability or your willingness to explore certain types of vulnerability is pretty amazing. I mean, like it's pretty terrifying for me to even think about, really, all of them, like the accused or Clarice or Nell specifically, who was basic. I mean, I know you felt a little insecure about the accused for these reasons, but did you feel uncomfortable with the vulnerability in retrospect of Nell?
I think that I mean, obviously I was drawn to Nell because I developed the play and, you know, got it off the ground and did all the years of work that I did to get that on screen. But I was scared of it. She is the most unlike me of anything that I've ever played. And I didn't know that I would have what it took. I think that I was scared of vulnerability and scared of being somebody like that. Like, I thought that if I was like that, I would just explode into a million pieces. Like, I just couldn't imagine what that would be. I didn't really know how to create that character. I was just so confused about how to create that character. And so it really was the greatest acting lesson of my life, where I realized, like, oh, all I have to do is drink coffee and show up and it will come because it's inside. Oh. There wasn't any books I could read particularly or research that I could do. Like, I had to just trust that when somebody said action, that I would be able to be there.
And you had to let go of a lot of who you,
of who I am,
the construction of you.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't mean that I didn't like go into a trance or anything.
Right. No, but you let yourself be, you let yourself be unafraid.
I let myself be unafraid. And I think that I allowed myself to believe in trolls.
Right.
And you have to believe in trolls sometimes. And it doesn't really matter whether they're real or not. It's because the belief is, you know, that's the whole point.
Right.
You know, when you're shepherding an audience through an experience like that, you have to be 100% authentic or the movie doesn't work. So there's a lot of pressure that comes with that. But there's also a lot of power to the fact that it's all riding on your performance. And if it's real, it works. And if it's not real, doesn't work.
Right. And you can see parts I haven't done a lot of movies, but I imagine that as somebody who's done a lot of movies, when you look back at the ones where you can say, like, I don't know if I was there, or I don't love that performance, you just let it go. Right. I mean, you can't get hung up on it.
Yeah. You can get hung up on it. You can waste a lot of years getting hung up on it. No, I don't. I mean, that's something I learned as a child.
Yeah.
That as an actor, I just don't have any control of it and I have to just go. And there are rituals to do that. I feel like there's always a ritual about that, you know.
Letting go?
When I'm hanging out the window on my way to the airport after the wrap party.
Yeah.
And, you know, we wrapped at 6 a.m. and I like throw all my shit in my thing. And then there I am and I'm out the window and I undo the window and I realize, like, half of me just finished this massive thing.
Right.
Like, I just finished climbing Mount Everest.
Yeah.
So I'm like, whew. And then the other half is like not quite back in the real life of who I am. And there's a little fear about that. That's the most delicious moment.
Yeah.
And that's like, I feel like that's a ritual for me where I just go like, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
That's done. Yeah. It's over now.
That weird, the in-between. The relief of being in between worlds.
Yeah. Where you don't have the anxiety of like, do I measure up? You know, can I do it? Right. No, you just did it. It's done.
It's done. It's over. It's out of your hands.
And then 10 minutes later, or when you get off the plane on the other side in LA, suddenly you're going to be like,
Yeah.
Gripped with anxiety that you don't measure up, you know?
Oh, my God. That was Jodie Foster from episode 1201. A few weeks ago, we had another Holdovers nominee on the show. Davine Joy Randolph was episode 1512, and that was fun. Like, when you got this part, because I lived in Boston for years.
Oh, dope.
Yeah, it was okay.
It's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How much time did you have to spend there?
We were there for 3 months, 3.5 months.
But did you have to go learn it? Boston?
No, yeah, okay, so they wanted us to live, like, around where we were filming. I'm from the city, so, like, I'm born and raised from Philadelphia, lived in New York, now I'm here in LA. I am a city girl.
Yeah.
So, like, too much quiet really freaks me out.
What happens?
And it's actually not good for, like...
for your brain?
Yeah, it's too quiet. Like, I remember the suburbs, the first time of, like, spending the night over, like, a friend's house.
When you were a kid?
Yeah, and I was like, what is that sound? And
isn't they that were weird? Like,
it's quiet.
Yeah.
It freaked me out.
It's scarier than noise.
Yes.
Like, if I'm driving across country or something, and you just see a house set back a little ways on its own.
What are they doing? Yeah,
exactly. Can't be good.
No. Those spots always freak me out. Yeah.
There's probably just people sitting in there, but the idea of it
literally makes me nervous.
Yeah, so the silence just fucks your head
so
up.
I was like, nope, this is an intense movie.
Yeah.
We're filming it the same time of year.
Cold.
As this movie's taking place.
Yeah.
Multiple blizzards, winter. You know, so it was like, I need to be in the city.
Yeah, because it's something about the isolation.
Yeah, it was already, I mean, you're already shooting a three-hander in abandoned buildings.
Yeah.
It felt like a very well-done independent student film.
Yeah. But it was freezing in the buildings?
Freezing because we couldn't have the heat on, right? Because the radiators were like, ding, 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 making all this noise.
Another level of the pretending.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But did you get around Boston? Did you, like, how'd you learn?
Yeah, because I lived, that's where I stayed.
In the city?
In the
city.
What part? I was like on First Street or Second Street. I could see the water or whatever their harbor was.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know exactly.
Charles River or the whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I found out like in our last 5 days, you know, like when you're on location, you don't know the area.
Yeah.
And then it's like that last week is like the most awesome week.
Right.
Because now you found the restaurants and the spots.
Yeah. Finally. I can live here.
But it was tricky for me because, they are speaking contemporary Boston dialect.
Uh-huh.
And so I needed to both be around them and then also be like, you know what I mean? Because my dialect that I'm doing in the movie is similar but also very different due to time period.
Yes, yes.
So it's
Like how'd you figure that out? With a dialect coach?
A dialect coach.
She said that like 70?
Yeah, so it was like late 1960s. We went for late 19. The movie literally takes place on like December 69 until January 70.
Oh my God.
So it was the biggest. So we did YouTube videos of like interviews and looking at like little like clips
people?
Of like, the best thing is, I call it YouTube University, but truly the best thing is finding like, news reporters interviewing people.
So
we was down there and they were talking about, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's a great. And then Donna Summer.
Boston. Come on.
Hardcore.
Really?
Hardcore Boston. So I'm looking at like her Johnny Carson interviews.
Wow.
And that was like my go-to gal. And then the realtor who helped me find the place, she was just so lovely hospitable. And was like little Miss Boston, and I would just listen to her all the time. And there were certain things that I was like, can I just record you say this word and this word? Because she was older, so she was a little bit closer to me than me going to Dunkin' Donuts. And I'm like,
But does it get more intense as time goes on? Is it father like that? What's the difference?
The biggest difference is that pacing.
Yeah.
Like the rhythm and the cadence.
Yeah,
you're a musician, so you get it. Like, it's more so like the lilts and the rhythm and the cadence.
I lived there for years.
Yeah, and I think it depends when Bostonians are upset.
Yeah.
Things get like
exaggerated and really bright, like five, and you're like, really?
Wow.
You don't want to stop it? You're still going.
Yeah. I used to live in an apartment in Somerville, and, you know, across the street, there was a drama all the time, drugs or whatever.
Of course.
And there was always, like, it seemed like every other night, there was a girl on the street yelling at her friend upstairs, going, Jennifer!
Yeah.
You know, like, Fah! Yeah. What is that?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I who is this dialect coach?
Tom Jones. So he's done, like, he's known to work with Nicole Kidman on almost everything.
Really?
Yeah.
Did he make you that, like, phonetic sheet?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I'm a classically trained opera singer, so I know IPA, you know, so in a way of helping.
What's IPA?
I think it's called the,
oh, the
International
Squigglies?
Phonetic Alphabet. Yeah. Like the diphthongs and the umlauts and stuff
you
like
know
that.
Those. Yeah, from opera.
Well, yeah. And then when I went to Yale, they made us learn it. And my speech and dialect coach was very frustrated with me because I'm a musician first. Right. So my ear is sharp.
Right.
So I could speak it. She was like, no, write it down.
Yeah,
it's like music theory. You know what I mean?
The
like,
theory's the worst.
We could do it all day, but write it down.
They're the worst.
I don't know what you're talking about. So he's great. I met him on the set of doing Billie Holiday, because he worked with Andra Day for Billie Holiday. And so I was always like, if ever it could work out, I would love to work with that man.
Yeah.
And it was perfect because I did that. And then right after that, worked with him on Rustin to do Mahalia Jackson. So he's great because he's so music-based.
Well, you've done a lot of time traveling.
I like time traveling.
It's the best.
Right?
Especially, you know, because some of those things like the Billie Holiday movie and Rustin is just so loaded with the tension and evolution of people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
One more Best Supporting Actress nominee, America Ferrara, who's nominated for Barbie. She was just on. That was episode 1514.
But with the monologue, which is like literally a page of dialogue.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. We didn't really rehearse it that way. We talked about it a lot, but we didn't rehearse it.
What was the conversations about mostly? Themes or like what?
It was a lot about, we shared a lot back and forth between like poetry and songs and episodes of TV shows and articles and op-eds, like everything that kind of felt like related to the monologue. We spent months kind of sharing to kind of have a common language around what is the essence of what's happening here. And then I remember closer to shooting, we had a rehearsal at her house that she was staying at in London, and we sat on her couch, and like that felt more like it was making it incredibly personal, you know, which I don't know how to do it any other way as an actress, but to make it deeply personal. And that was about kind of us relating it to us, you know, she and I, and like how this plays in our life.
Huh.
And then on the day I was like, what is this supposed to sound like? You know, I was like, is this supposed to be funny, or is it just drama, or is it, you know, is it fat? Do you want me to keep it up? Like, is it supposed to sound like everything else in Barbie Land? And she really just like, was the only time like looked at me and was like, I just want you to find it. And she gave me so much freedom. And there were takes that had hysterical laughing. There were takes that had hysterical tears. There were incredibly angry takes. And, you know, and like that, you know, it went so many different places.
Yeah.
And then I did it so many different times. And I had no idea. I'm like, I'm literally like, and not because I was like looking for, it was just like, okay, I'll just drop into it and see where it goes this time.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like, now I'll do a funny take.
Right.
Now I'll do, it was just like, each time it was just find a thread, pull it, and follow the thread.
And they were all subtly different?
And they were all very different.
Wow.
And so when it was done, I was like, she's going to have to decide, and she's going to have to find it. And I was, you know, very confident that she would. And that
it was in there, that it was, you did it. Yeah.
And I think the other question was like, how does this, like, how does this fit into the rest of the movie, right?
Well, I mean, it seems to me like, now before I say that, but did you add stuff on the day?
We didn't add stuff on the day. No, no. There was no improv.
Oh, yeah.
We had talked about certain.
So you built it out.
We built some things in, we tweaked and.
Right.
Yeah.
But it seems like from months before, she knew it was like going to define the third act, if not be the centerpiece of the movie.
Yes. When she first sent me the script, she said, I wrote this thing that I'm calling Gloria's Aria. And it's the moment that.
Everything
shifts
yeah.
and changes everything. And so from the beginning, she was like,
right. So she knew
there's this thing and I want yeah. it to be you. And it right. was just felt like a, it just felt like a dream. Like it's just something I never expected.
But your responsibility in the movie is kind of, I'm just thinking out loud now. I mean, you are the human.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
The only human.
Yeah.
And your
and
daughter.
And my daughter, yeah, Ariana.
Because the corporate guys aren't human.
No, they're like, yeah. yeah.
So the whole movie hinges on your humanity in a way.
Yeah. I mean, it, yeah, yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome for representing all of humanity. It was challenging. You yeah. know what was challenging? Was how hard it was to not give in to the energy of Barbie Land. Like everyone's right. like dancing and singing and yeah. it's Barbie Land and everything's heightened. And I'm like, I want to do that. And yeah. it's like, oh, I'm not here to do that. I'm here to be the human, warts and all.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there was the thing I had to unlock for myself in playing the character was, here is a woman who is has a childlike imagination and desire and a need to play and suspend disbelief and like believe that Barbie's coming for her and taking her into the real world.
Sure.
Like
wants it.
There's a childlike yeah. Yearning there, and she's deeply, deeply human, frustrated. She's a real woman. She knows the disappointment of life.
Challenges.
And also, you know, her teen daughter is like pulling away from her and mm-hmm. making her feel kind of rejected. And yeah. so it was, you know, all these very real human feelings coupled with the fantastical energy of a child yeah. in one woman's body. And when I started out, that seemed like, how am I going to play that?
Yeah.
And actually what I realized is like, I am that. And and we're just so not used to seeing women get to be all those things.
Yeah.
Like that she gets to be taken seriously and be real and be considered deep and smart and all the things and get to seek play yeah. and childlike wonder and yeah. and so it was sort of like in a way through the process of being Gloria finding for my, giving myself America the permission to be more of what I am.
Yeah, that's great.
So it was a really deep journey,
life changing.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
And finally, to round out the supporting actors, here's some of my talk with Mark Ruffalo from episode 1513, who's nominated for his performance in Poor Things.
I mean, I think what you respond to in Duncan, like Duncan can be played just straight across the board, pretty much that way. Like
the guy in Poor Things?
Yeah, yeah. yeah. And to drop down into that, really drop down into his sort of insecurity,
yeah.
and he becomes empathetic.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah. There's a couple
this
of scenes.
Horrible narcissist.
Well, that's why it's hilarious, because you do feel empathy for him.
Yeah.
Wow. I just realized the bipolar must have helped with the Hulk a little bit,
buddy. These doublings keep showing up in my life all the time. I mean, I'm always playing these like dual people. That have one side and then another side, and the Hulk is like the, you know, the just the absolute clear manifestation
yeah.
of that.
Yeah, yeah, and you approach that with humanness.
Yeah, you try. I mean, that's what we hold on to in films, you know? I mean, you can do a bit for so long.
Yeah.
I mean, bits are fun and just pure comedy.
Sure.
It works really well, you know? But I'm always looking for that a little bit deeper cut.
Have you hosted SNL?
No.
Why not?
I'm scared.
They've offered it to you?
Yeah. Oh. I'll never be asked back.
No?
Well, I don't think Lauren Michaels likes when you say no.
Well, yeah. Well, I guess not. But no, what about that? I mean, you've done theater.
Just scared the living shit. I don't know.
Huh.
I don't know. It was...
It's not the live thing, is it?
I think it was... It's a live thing, like reading off a cue card.
That's hard.
It scares me.
Yeah.
Because I'm dyslexic. I mean, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
You don't lie on this show.
Like, yeah.
So I'm really dyslexic.
Like, how dyslexic?
Like... I'll lose where I'm at on
right,
a page,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And you know, I'm just, when I hear about how that show works and they're changing things at the last second.
Oh, yeah. So
and I want to be good on it, man.
Right.
I've been watching that my whole life. And like, I don't want to be the guy who's the host who sucks on Saturday Night Live, you know?
No.
Like, I owe Lauren Michaels more than that, you know? Like,
well, are you one of those people that you could memorize the shit? Like, pretty much quick?
No, that's the other thing.
Yeah.
Like, I have the double whammy. Like I'm dyslexic and I have a hard time memorizing stuff. Like, I have to start so early.
With any script?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
But that's not part of the dyslexia. That's just you. Right?
It's just me. That's one of those things that you're talking about.
You can't do anything about the memory.
No, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Ginkgo, you know, now it's wasabi. Yeah. I chase all the memory shit.
You tried? You know?
I try everything.
Yeah.
I've tried everything across the board.
But so what happens? But you, how many times do you read the script?
Well, you know, the most important reading's like that first one.
It is.
And just like immerse. See, the way I read is I literally, for a 1 hour, of, you know, 60-page script, 90-page script, it takes me like 4 hours to read it.
Right, okay. Well, so that's interesting because your dyslexia enables you a type of concentration that other people don't have.
Yes, and I fall in. I have to envision every single scene. Like I have to like see it.
Yeah, yeah.
To understand where I'm at. You
right,
know?
Right.
So it takes me longer than the movie. If you were sat down and watched the movie to read it. So it's a blessing. You know, it's like all these things. They're blessings and they're curses.
Well, that's wild because so that means in order just to process the words. You know, you've got to attach the feelings, and it takes, you know, it's like a full immersive experience.
Totally. I'm living in it. If I'm reading a book,
yeah.
I can't, like, read a script at the same time. Otherwise, I start mixing up the worlds, you know?
And you have to see yourself in everything, I guess.
Kind of. I mean, that first read is so essential because it's the first time it's coming to you so fresh.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if you can, and you end up like playing that first read. I mean, in a lot of ways, all the information, all of the spontaneity of that first read, all of your like the imagination kicking off all these connections, that ends up being the most informative read of the entire thing.
Yeah, yeah. And then would you just kind of then go scene to scene and lock in?
Yeah, yeah.
Once you do the read, you got it in your head?
Yes, then I'll go back and I'll do scene to scene. Sometimes, you know, you want to know where you came from and where you're going in a scene. You
Dude,
know?
That is the hardest thing about shooting.
Yes.
It's like, all right, so this is 9 days before you were bleeding.
Yes.
And you're like...
and then you ran away from the explosion and you run into this room and, you know, you really have to keep a hand
I think that's
that.
The only reason you need a director or a script supervisor is because you're like, what happened?
Where are we? where was this? Okay, wait. Right. Okay.
Oh, my God. Yeah, but do you ever watch yourself and go like, I didn't know.
All the time. I can't. I mean, literally, I'm watching myself, and I'm just sinking down in a chair.
But no one knows but you.
I hope so.
Going back to an episode from several years ago, Best Director nominee Yorgos Lanthimos was on back in 2019. He's nominated this year for Poor Things and also has a Best Picture nomination for that film as one of its producers. What was the first kind of mind-blowing moment when you were watching a film and you're like, oh, this is...
I guess... you know, Tarkovsky was one of the, you know, first filmmakers that I got to learn through film school that I didn't know anything about.
So that was in a film history class?
Yeah, so we learned about it, and then there's some nice, you know, during summer in Greece, there's a lot of open-air cinemas. I mean, there are not as many anymore.
Yeah.
But there are beautiful open-air cinemas in various neighborhoods where you can, you know, have a little table and you eat something.
Yeah.
And you're outside, yeah, surrounded by apartment buildings.
Yeah.
And you watch films. So they would do, like, retrospectives. So
yeah.
I would watch his films and then... John Cassavetes was...
What was it about Tarkovsky specifically that you found sort of engaging?
Well, it was just for the first time seeing like a different... It was like a different, completely different medium, you know, discovering like something new.
A vision.
Like how, vision. You know, how can images affect you in a different way?
Right.
It doesn't have to be... a fast narrative, and mm-hmm. you know how poetic it can be, and how you can, you know, lose yourself in it and
right.
Engage, but with your own personality. There's a lot of openness to
yeah.
it. Like you can bring your own stuff into
yeah,
it
yeah.
and see things and understand things in maybe in a different way to how the person next to you is
yeah.
Experiencing the same thing at the same time.
Right, not everything's not explained.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And yeah, the use of sound and image, and it was very different for me, and I was, you know, and then, you know, like watching right after that a John Cassavetes film, which is very different stylistically,
yeah, sure.
but for me, in a weird way, it has a very similar effect, but through a different route.
Yeah, it's a human driven space.
Yeah,
you know, I mean the few Tarkovsky movies I've seen, you know, it's a lot of cinematic space, but with Cassavetes, there's something heightened, but you know, it's very engaged with people.
Yeah. But the fact that it's so heightened also takes it to a different level,
yeah,
and
yeah,
you start.
Yeah.
And although it feels kind of more realistic, it kind of transcends that, and
yeah.
then you enter a different space again. So,
yeah, and there's also that feeling like these people are talking, and the context seems familiar to me, but I don't know what the fuck is happening.
Yeah.
What's going on with these people?
Yeah,
that's a good. I think that's a good feeling, I guess.
No, it's again. It's I enjoy, you know, watching films like that. I guess what I'm trying to do is, you know, create films like the ones that I'd like to see.
Because
like,
you watch movies constantly.
I watch a lot of movies. I'm not like an obsessed like
yeah.
Film buff or anything. But I do. I tend to watch the same films over and over again.
Like which
I feel
ones?
Safe.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. They're familiar. They're like friends.
Yeah. So, and yeah, I'd rather watch something that I really like than.
What's
you know.
Like, which ones have you watched over and over? Like, every time it's like sometimes I'll just be watching TV or cable and one will come on. I'm like, I'm in. I don't, it doesn't even matter where it starts. I just watched Casino again the other day. I don't
yeah.
even know why. Because like, I have
I've
to.
Seen that, like, quite a few times.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, it's a great film.
Can you watch how like I found that as I get older I'm not able to watch the head in the vice scene as much as I was. Like I used to be able to
You're
watch
more
it.
Sensitive?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. I was just sort of like, I don't know if I need this tonight. I know what's gonna happen here.
The weird thing with me is like how much affected I can get by those kind of things. Being so much, you know, on the inside and seeing how these things are created.
Even though you know how it works.
Yeah, you know how it works. The difficult thing is for me to be affected by these things.
Yeah.
And that's when I know that a film really grabbed me because I forget about the way it's made. And,
yeah,
you
you're
know,
not
the,
sitting there going like, oh, I know how they
yeah,
do that. I understand that shot. I understand that.
Exactly. When you're able to do that and be someone that is actually making film, then
yeah.
that's like very strong.
Right. Yeah, oh, yeah. That's Yorgos Lanthimos from episode 992. So, okay, Barbie, which I loved, is nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, and both writers have been on the show. Noah Baumbach was on episode 388, and after him, you'll hear Greta Gerwig's most recent appearance from episode 1502. I'm sort of fascinated with people that grow up in New York. Like, you're a real New York kid, mm-hmm. and your parents were part of that sort of, what is, I would say, the mid-70s intelligentsia. I mean, you grew up in the thick of it when Brooklyn was still, you know, just for those kind of writers and not for punks and kids.
Right.
What, when you were just, how old are you now?
43.
So your mother was a New York, Village Voice writer who I remember reading.
She was a voice, but she started writing for The Voice when I was more late high school, college. So I didn't grow up. Sometimes people say, oh, you grew up with a critic. But I didn't really feel like – she kind of started doing it a little later. So it was more like, oh, cool. We get to see movies for free.
Right. What was she doing before that?
She was a teacher. She had written some short stories. She was figuring it out.
Uh-huh.
A mom.
Yeah, figuring it out. Right. Yeah. She had two kids, and she's like, where's my life?
Yeah.
And your old man was a writer.
Yes.
Do you get along with him? Is he?
I do get along with him very well. But, yeah, he was a novelist and teacher.
Right.
Also big film. He wrote sometimes about film. But, you know, in the 70s, there was that thing where there was almost no delineation between critic and writer. You were kind of doing it all.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's personality driven in a way.
Yeah.
You want to be known for that. You're that guy that can write on everything. Broad, a general critic of sorts.
But, yeah, because I made this movie, The Squid and the Whale, which was kind of had some connection to my childhood, at least in the very straightforward way. So people sometimes assume I don't get along with my parents, but I am close to my parents.
Was there a reaction to The Squid? I mean, I had to refresh myself because I'd seen it, you know, probably twice when it came out. And I went to the Wikipedia page of The Squid and the Whale, and just reading the plot sign, yeah, you know, the plot and line, I kind of choked up at the end. I don't know what the fuck's wrong with me this morning. This is not the like, I don't do interviews this early sometimes. I think I'm still a little raw.
I love the idea of, like, the Wikipedia page will make you cry.
It did.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'd forgotten how the actual that exhibit at the Museum of Natural History, how it was contextualized in the movie.
Yeah.
So being reminded by it and the way they sort of framed it, you know, that this was this moment that your mother comforted you in front of this horrible thing, which I remember seeing as a kid. And mm-hmm. it is horrible because it's kind of dark and you can always see the... And then you go back to it, and I choked up. That's all.
That's great. I'm thrilled to. We don't even need the DVD anymore. You can just read the page.
Just read the plot line. Well, my experience with the movie was the first time I saw it, I was overwhelmed emotionally. Like, I have a thing about musicals, and I don't know if this is, would you call it a musical, but it's framed like a musical. It could have been a musical.
Yeah, I mean,
easily.
Yeah, it's almost like it's half a musical.
Yeah.
It wants to be a musical.
Yeah, yeah. And sort of the unity of everything and the very specific vision of it. But I don't know what it is with me in terms of, you know, how emotional I got in a good way about just the way the women were talking. And it speaks to a very odd thing and a very sad thing about movies in general is that you realize that in mainstream movies that there's not a lot of women talking in general.
Right.
And so, but just the fact that there was this conceit that enabled them to talk, you know, plainly and curtly, but in a very emotional and intellectual way was kind of amazing.
It felt amazing on the set. I have to say, it was like small things that felt amazing. When we did even the scene with Margot and Ryan, and he said, asked to stay over, and she says, oh, but I don't want you here. And she just said it like she's not being mean. It's, you know, she's just saying what she feels.
Right.
And it was sort of amazing.
Well, because it undermines the whole expectation, because there is no sexuality in a way. Because we all know that, and you make reference to it maybe twice, that they don't have genitals.
No.
But so that interaction, which is naturally loaded with anything, all the baggage that anyone's going to bring to it, is able to have this honesty that's devoid of sexual expectation or manipulation.
Also devoid of her
needing to placate any ego.
Yeah.
That there's no, it wouldn't even occur to her.
Right.
Well, to
placate his ego.
Like, they're like, oh, no, it's not, it doesn't enter right. it at all.
But that's interesting because in those scenes, you know, the male ego more so is intact.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yeah, right.
So he, you know, she doesn't acknowledge it or recognize it, but that's all they have.
Yes, yes, the Kens. The Kens are. It's funny. Like, actually, Ryan, from the very beginning, no one I wrote the part for him, but we didn't know him, and it was getting him the script and then saying like, no, we really wrote it for you. Like, we wrote this for
you.
He
didn't believe it?
Well, no, I think he did once he started reading it, because his name is all over the script. I mean, because we'd say Ken Ryan Gosling, like.
But it's so funny because he's so, like, those guys, there's something about those Canadians sometimes. Oh, they're very funny.
Oh, they're so funny.
In a very specific way. It's a non-neurotic kind of presence.
That's true.
And they're very good at just isolating the funny and locking in. Ryan Reynolds the same way.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not, there's no kind of like, though Ken had to struggle with self-awareness, The comedic element of it is just pure.
It's pure. And it's also based in it. I think he takes it seriously, which is part of what made it funny, which I had an instinct that he'd do. And then he did it so completely. And he said, I think the first time we talked on the phone, he said he found his daughters had Barbies. And then he said to himself, I think they have a Ken somewhere. And then he found it like face down in the mud next to a squished lemon. And he's like, this is Ken. No one cares about him. And I was like, it was just instantly like, yes, that's exactly right.
So he got the emotional universe
right away.
Okay, look, now for our nominees from Killers of the Flower Moon. First, a great unique talk with director of photography Rodrigo Prieto, who's nominated for Best Cinematography for that film. This was from our recent episode 1515.
When we got back into pre-production, I already had all these notions and started showing Scorsese images and then shooting tests and seeing what he liked. And he was at the moment so involved in the script and all that he kind of was letting me run free for a little bit. With all these ideas and stuff. And then he started getting inspired too and throwing ideas as well. And we tested all sorts of things from pinhole photography, infrared, all sorts of things.
Well, it seems like, it seems like, especially with the Native Americans, that there was something about composition that was reminiscent of those documentary photographs of the era.
Yeah.
That were sort of trying to show examples of the pride of Native Americans. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know what you drew from in terms of still photography, but did you?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because that really became the basis of the look of the film, not only in composition, but I thought, okay, this movie is a representation of the story of the Osage and the FBI.
Yeah.
At the same time, we see in the film these newsreel images, for example. And towards the end, we see a radio show telling that story.
Yeah.
And stories are also told with still photography. So I thought that basing the look on still photography was a way of showing that we're also telling a story that's being remembered. So I decided to, this is where we ended up, looking at the beginnings of color photography.
Yeah.
I got deep into autochrome, which is a technique to create color that the Lumiere brothers invented in Paris. I think it was around 1917. Mm. And so I started testing digitally, we shot on film, but digitally emulating the look of autochrome colors. It's a system of creating kind of transparencies on glass plate with potato starch and dyes and all sorts of funky
stuff. You were doing that?
No.
Okay.
I was emulating that. Okay. But I studied many autochrome photographs
to
understand what was happening to the colors.
Okay.
How grass looks, how an apple looks,
oh,
how
interesting.
The sky looks, so we created what's called the lookup table, LUT, to emulate autochrome, because it's also an import from Europe. Just like the white people are imported from Europe, the descendants of the settlers.
Yeah.
So everything that has to do with Ernest and Hale and the white folk, I use this LUT of autochrome. And the Osage, the scenes that are just Osage, we shot completely naturalistic in terms of color. So green is, you know, is green, and all the foliage is the actual color, and the sky, you know, so it's naturalistic.
Right.
The Europeans are autochrome. And so then, so I showed these ideas to Scorsese. He liked it. I shot tests. He loved it. And then he said, so then what? How does the look evolve? So I said, how about we pick a moment in the movie where things shift and we change to something else? Okay, what would it be? And so I thought, well, a technique we used actually in The Irishman before was ENR, which is a technique of printing film, motion picture film.
Yeah.
That adds contrast and takes away color. And it's pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
So we decided that once the Molly's sister's house explodes, Rita's house, and and all hell breaks loose, now, from then on, we don't differentiate between the white people and the Osage. Everybody is seen through ENR, high contrast. It's harsher.
Yeah.
The image is harder.
Yeah.
So let's say the last third of the movie has that look to it. And also the lighting, I evolved into something sometimes uncomfortable. Like Ernest, we see him several times in hot light, either from a light bulb or in the cells or in the interrogation. He has this ugly light coming from above, or in the courtroom. He's giving his deposition, whatever you call it. And I put direct sun on his face, which is a movie light, but it feels uncomfortable. It feels hot.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when you're in a place and the sun's hitting your face, you're not comfortable.
Yeah.
So I tried to do that with his character.
Was the turn, it seems like around the time of the fires too, that De Niro set.
Yeah, that's part of that too.
Yeah.
That whole sequence. And also, precisely around there, we allowed ourselves to be a tiny bit surrealistic because it's kind of hell now is
enveloping like
everybody, you know.
How'd you shoot that? Was that all intentional?
Kind of, and yes and no. It was one of those things where you design something and something else happens that you didn't expect. In the case of the fire scenes, we had two cameras. One was shooting a wide shot with the house and the fires and the people moving around, just a wide shot.
Yeah.
And then we had another camera with a very long lens. So it's like a, you know, like a telephoto, like a telescope, let's say, shooting just some of the people through at the distance.
Yeah.
So I had fires, special effects fires with pipes and gas and stuff, way in the distance to create silhouettes of the people. And then we had another layer between the camera and those people that had another layer of fire through pipes. And then I had close to the lens, off camera, just a pipe to create heat waves.
Yeah.
So I knew that with these heat waves, there'd be a distortion to the image. But what I didn't count on was that the second layer of fire created a much stronger distortion to the image. So we're actually seeing through the heat waves.
Yeah.
And it created we first of all, we couldn't get focus on the actors in the distance.
Yeah.
And then I asked the focus puller, okay, pull to the distortion. So move the focus closer, and then suddenly it came alive, you know. So we were actually putting focus on the heat waves themselves, and that's what created those weird silhouettes.
Yeah, wild.
Yeah.
The hell.
It was, and I remember when we were shooting, we all were surprised, and Scorsese was loving it so much that he kept shooting it and asking the choreographer to move them this way or that way, and it was just mesmerizing.
Oh, wow. And he's got a very specific way of choreographing violence.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. In fact, on The Irishman, he purposefully, he wanted to shoot it and show it in the same thing, a similar thing actually on this film, in a very dry manner where it's maybe on a wide shot.
Yeah.
You know, it's not dramatic and in your face and sexy.
Right.
The opposite.
Yeah.
It's ugly and boom, it just happens, you know, in a second.
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah.
You know, and so we see some of the murders of the Osage in that manner where it's just simple. We don't do a dramatic close-up of the guy and the gun close to the lens and the focus pulls to the, you know, trigger.
Yeah, sure.
None of that.
Yeah.
The sweat, none of that.
Yeah.
You know, so
it makes it more disturbing in a way.
Exactly. Yeah.
From the distance.
I feel so, yeah.
Yeah. Just last week, we had Lily Gladstone on. She's nominated for Best Actress for her performance in Killers of the Flower Moon.
On one hand, like maybe rewatches the film and people commit to like the little nuances in it, which kind of bowl over you the first watch, which honestly is kind of what most people give any film is one watch. But there was this whole guardianship program set up. Osages being deemed incompetent of handling their own money.
Right.
Literally incompetent Osage is the title that was on your paperwork. You had to have a white person appointed to be your guardian of your money.
Yeah.
And it was of benefit to a lot of people to be married to their guardian. Because then right. you like just say, hey, honey, write a check for me to do this.
Right.
You know, and Osage women, are they own everything, you know, culturally.
Oh, that's so funny. It's sort of like musicians today.
Yeah. What do you call a musician without a girlfriend?
Broke.
Homeless. But yeah.
But your character, you know, as it evolves in the movie, are acutely aware of this.
Yeah. Acutely aware of some elements of it. The thing that was a big, like, clue, and that came from, I was so grateful in my language lessons to be given this story by Christopher Cote. It's a trickster story. Shomikazi Coyote is one of their trickster figures. Sure. And Coyote's the, like, hedonistic, self-serving, like, fop.
Yeah.
And immediately, you know, asked around the community and got permission to use that analogy. And everybody was like, oh, yeah, absolutely. That makes sense.
For who? For Leo?
For Leo. Uh-huh. Yeah, I was like, okay, Molly sees him as this coyote. She sees him as this trickster. So that first scene, calling him out for that, that was something that was added in later. But it's kind of like, all right, I got your number. I know how this story ends.
Right.
Like, so Molly, you know, finding this man who self, you know, he admits it, you know, I like to make a party at night and sleep all day. I sure do love money. Sure do love whiskey. She's like, all right, good. You're easy. You know?
I get you.
I get you. I got your number. I can handle you. And you'll enjoy money, but you'll also write my checks for me. And, you know, you look good. So this works for me.
Right.
So on both elements, there was like definitely a chemistry and a playfulness, but there was definitely a mutual benefit. And then eventually there became real love there. And, you know,
with the elements. Kids.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it, is you see a man that is so committed and so much loves his kids. There's no way you're going to suspect that he would do anything to hurt them or you. Even if you do suspect it, you know, how easy it is. And I think a lot of people who are in relationships that are maybe not this abusive to the point of being poisoned to death, but, you know, these dynamics.
Yeah, that's a very specific, systemic gaslighting.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that as a metaphor is what it is.
Yep, absolutely. And as a larger metaphor, committing to this love story was a way of looking at it as an analogy for the broken trust that colonization, United States government has had with indigenous peoples. It's been nothing but entering into trust relationships that are supposed to be mutually beneficial and then just the continual erosion of our sovereignty,
right,
which is what you're seeing happen to Molly. And, you know, we work within the systems that we can. We maintain, like, our own communities as much as we can. When you're crippled by these situations of, you know, guardianship or being wards of the U.S. government, of not having true sovereignty, then there's not a lot of option. There's not a lot of other way out. You have to be very creative. You have to be very subversive. You have to be very together.
And ultimately, you know, where we're at now, though, I think contextualized differently, is still directly related to that.
Yeah. And we're still continually entering into trust relationships and good faith.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so this, on a microcosm, this relationship felt like a good way to have this conversation for what the film's really about.
And what do you, and with Marty, Marty had seen certain women. Is that what you?
Apparently, yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
I'm not sure at what point in the process he saw it, but I know that when he did, he saw what he needed for Molly. Because somebody like Kelly made a film the way she makes films.
Right.
You know, I remember one of the films that I studied and loved, still one of my favorite movies to this day, The Adaptation.
Oh, yeah.
Charlie
Kaufman's
script. That's
great. Yeah.
So good.
I watched that recently. Yeah.
It's so, and it still holds up.
Sure.
Every performance, every character, the writing, like the meta qualities in the writing that are so funny.
Yeah.
Like I've seen that film so many times and I would just study it.
Yeah.
And I remember Nicolas Cage as, you know, Charlie.
Yeah.
Talking about, you know, why can't a story just be about flowers?
Yeah.
And I remember thinking that when I was watching, it's like, yeah, I'd watch that movie.
Yeah.
Then years later, here's Kelly Reichardt. It's like, oh, this movie, it's kind of just really about horses, kind of really just about ranching. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's saying everything.
And right.
I think, like, maybe the neuroses that that of a writer that Kaufman was kind of tongue-in-cheek handling in that film is what gets in the way of just the observational quality a lens has and just the trust that your audience, if they've sought out this kind of film, they're going to make those connections themselves.
Oh, yeah, and Nicolas Cage's relationship with that tape recorder. Okay.
So good.
Hunched over.
Dawn of Time. We're starting here. The sweat. God, the way that he was able to sustain this comedic timing with himself.
Yeah.
That's just like, that's every actor's dream is to play their own twin, I think.
Yeah, he's kind of an awesome character in real life, I imagine, as well. Have you ever met him?
I have not, but I love watching his interviews. Like when Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent came out at South By.
Yeah.
I remember he was just went on in one of his interviews about, I'm wearing this because I wanted to look like shortbread because now I just really want to eat shortbread.
Sir,
you're a work of art.
Yeah, an authentic weirdo.
Yep.
Yeah. That was Lily Gladstone, episode 1516. And finally, folks, a talk with a nominee who sadly won't be at the award show this year. Robbie Robertson is nominated posthumously for Best Score for Killers of the Flower Moon. And I had the chance to talk to him back in 2017, episode 781. This is the repository of all my life shit.
It's just nice to take it all in.
Yeah.
And, you know, it either all starts out in a garage or ends up in a garage.
Yeah, mine ended up in a garage. That could go either way, too, the ending in a garage. That could either be a good thing. But you didn't start in a garage.
Well, there was garages, you know, and this house that the band found up by Woodstock.
The Pink House.
The Pink House. Big Pink, we called it.
Yeah.
And in the basement.
Yeah.
Which I don't even know that I've ever said this before, but when you went down into the basement, it wasn't just the basement, it was a garage too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because there was a big door that could open and you could drive a car in.
Okay.
But we never did because we wanted to use that space
for
making music instead.
It's funny, that I think that environment, that, and I was thinking about this, and we'll go back in time in a minute, but like it seems to me that whatever happened in that house, you know, with Dylan and with you guys, seemed to set the standard for how to make that kind of music, how to make connected, sort of earthy, you know, music that evolves, you know, as a group. I mean, it seems like now there's a whole resurgence of people aspiring to be what you guys were.
You know, at the time when we did the basement tapes, and this idea of making music in your home,
right,
and that was special because I'd had no real expectations to it, so it had such a relaxed atmosphere, and it even was like nobody was supposed to hear this,
right, and wasn't Dylan? It's sort of he was sort of kind of considering his mortality after an accident and just kind of hanging out at the time?
You know, he had had this accident, and he'd hurt himself pretty bad.
Right.
He had to wear like a neck brace for quite a while. But after that, and when we found this house, it became like the clubhouse.
Right.
You know, where guys would go every day and hang out.
Like who?
Like a street gang kind of thing.
Yeah, you guys. But were there other people, hangers-on, people around?
Not too much.
Yeah.
And it was a place to go every day, like a workshop or something.
Yeah.
It turned into this. And this had been a dream of mine. If we could only have the clubhouse where we would go every day and we could lock ourselves away from the world and create something that we are meant to do, that we are on a mission to do. And when I took Bob out there to see it, at first, you know, because he'd only made music really in recording studios and things. And when I took him out and showed him this, all of a sudden, I could see a light went off over his head, and he was like, can you really make music in here, and can you put it down on tape? And
yeah.
All of this was a revelation, and at that time, nobody was doing this.
Right.
It was really unusual, and it was something that I had in the back of my mind that I thought Les Paul did.
Oh, really?
Les Paul.
When he was screwing around with the electronics.
Right.
Yeah.
He had a house.
Right.
And he had like an echo chamber in the side of a cliff or yeah. something. I thought, that's the way you do it. And when I heard his records, the records that he made with Mary Ford,
yeah.
they didn't sound like anything else.
Right.
That how do you make a record that doesn't sound like anything else? And it's in your own environment? Woo. Right. So anyway, I'd been talking to the other guys in the band and to Bob about this for a long time. And when we found that place,
yeah.
it was like, this is it. This is Valhalla. This is where we can go,
yeah.
hang out,
yeah.
and create and do something that has nothing to do with the rest of the world.
That's the late Robbie Robertson on episode 781. If you want to hear any of these full episodes ad-free and also get more Oscar talk from the two bonus episodes we're doing this week, subscribe to The Full Marin. Just click on the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. Tomorrow's a regular episode with comedian Rory Scovel. All right? Okay. I'll talk to you later. Bye.